Great things astonish us, and small dishearten us. Custom makes both familiar. Jean de la Bruyère. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I appreciate it. If you're a newcomer, welcome again. And please feel free to go back and watch our backlog or listen to our backlog of episodes. And if you're a returning listener, thank you as always. I cannot stress how much I appreciate you guys. And please, to anyone who is listening, like, subscribe, download, rate, whatever kind of thing that your platform recommends to kind of make note of what you're listening to and kind of expand the download. I'd really appreciate it. The channel's seen a lot of growth the last couple of months, and I'd like that to continue. And I'd like it to continue a little bit quicker, but you know, feel free. I'd appreciate it. But regardless, thank you for joining me. So this week, we're going to be continuing to talk about human developments happening in the Indian subcontinent between 6 and 4,000 BC. Specifically, we will be focusing more on north-central/northwestern India. And this, when I say India, I mean the subcontinent. And so this will include parts of modern-day India, Bangladesh, Nepal, and Bhutan. Though the second two areas we might not touch on too heavily until next week. We'll just have to wait and see. Before we dive too heavily onto that, though, I did have a couple of pieces of feedback, and actually a couple of IRL listeners that I know personally. They had both kind of brought up a similar question just at different times. It was very funny to have them kind of ask generally the same thing. But they asked me, you know, how many languages, kind of, this is kind of a rough approximation of what they ask. How many language families do I think, you know, were spoken at India at any given time? And that's a very, you know, impossible question to ask, or to answer, not ask, obviously. They asked it perfectly fine. I'm not able to answer it. I don't think there are any linguists who are able to answer it, but it would not surprise me that, you know, it was quite a lot. Today, in the Indian subcontinent, there are over, I believe, it's between 800 and 900 languages, depending on if you consider something a language or a dialect. There's a lot of debate of that for some of those among linguists. I think the only place in the world that has more, the only kind of area in the world that has more languages spoken in the bounds of that area than India is Indonesia. They have over 1,000 languages. And you have to remember, there are a lot of isolated languages in Indonesia, a lot of islands that only have like one or two languages on them. So, you know, depending on how isolated a region in India was, there could have been a couple languages spoken there. So it's impossible to say for sure. I would guess a lot. but, you know, again, just because the language is lost does not mean that the descendants of those people are lost. It just means they're speaking a different tongue or something along those lines. So that's something, you know, we'll discuss a little bit more as we go forward. with all that out of the way, though, it is time to go ahead and dive into the subject for this week's episode. Now, much like I mentioned in our episode a couple of weeks ago about the southern portion of the subcontinent, the archaeological record for this area at the time frame of this episode is a little murky, and this is due to similar reasons as, you know, the subcontinent or the southern part of the subcontinent, the Deccan Peninsula or Deccan Plateau. There are very similar reasons why archaeological record isn't as clear. The climate is much more humid and tropical, with lots of trees and plant growth that breaks down pretty much every human artifact that was not stone. And another big reason that it may be difficult to find archaeological evidence is that there are two very big river systems that are, you know, contributing to, you know, probably artifacts being swept away or being, you know, covered in mud and things like that, because these rivers have shifted at some point in recorded history and in, I'm sure, prehistory. These are, of course, the river systems of the Ganges and the Brahmaputra River. And again, these are very massive river systems. And, you know, while there are, you know, certainly sizable rivers in the south, they're not nearly as large. And I think their courses haven't shifted quite as dramatically during, at least from what we've seen during the historical period or the period that we're discussing, mainly because they're coming through mountains with like those hard stones and things like that. It doesn't shift quite as dramatically. Now the Ganges and the Brahmaputra are coming down from, or at least some of their rivers are coming down from the Himalayas. But that's not where the shifts are happening. They're happening after they get out of the hills and they're kind of moving through this long plain that stretches from, you know, further to the west into the east. So I think at one point, actually, the Brahmaputra just went straight south into the Bay of Bengal, but now it has it's shifted and kind of curves more to the east and then curves back to the south at that point. But that's all stuff that we'll talk about later. But that's probably another reason the archaeological record isn't clear. The river systems, even if it's not the Ganges and Brahmaputra directly, you know, they're smaller rivers, they're feeder rivers and streams. They're probably covering up some things as well. And of course, you have, you know, there's monetary issues with conducting large-scale research. There's still a lot to study in sites that have already been uncovered. So, you know, sometimes due to lack of funding, you kind of have to focus on what you know. Now, I think eventually we probably will find more, you know, things to kind of dive into. But we're going to kind of cover some of the highlights of what we know about right now. Before that, though, I did want to kind of go over the etymology of the Ganges and the Brahmaputra. I think I did this a little bit, and it's not going to be quite as in-depth just yet because there is some religious slash mythological aspects to their names. And again, I kind of don't want to dive into that too heavily just yet for India, but I will kind of give a brief overview of those two names. The Ganges is named for the Hindu goddess Ganga. She's an extremely important goddess. She has a couple of different aspects to her, in addition to being kind of the embodiment of the Ganges River, or the personification of the Ganges River, as the case may be. She is also very importantly a goddess of forgiveness and purification. The waters of the Ganges are sacred to any Hindu. They will cleanse your sins, and there are a lot of religious festivals and rites that involve cleansing oneself in the waters of the Ganges. Now, her father is Himavat, who is the personification of the Himalayan mountains, which, if you look at a map of the Ganges water system, that makes a lot of sense because, well, that's where kind of the headwaters for numerous branches or, I guess, tributaries of the Ganges kind of come down from, in addition to the Ganges itself, starting kind of coming down from the Himalayan mountains. Her mother is, there's a couple different versions depending on what story you're reading or what region you're in about who her mother is. Well, her mother's always the same, but her mother's origin is different. It's the goddess Manivadi. And depending again on the source you're looking at, she is either the daughter of the cosmic mountain, Mount Meru. But in some other one, she's a member of a specific social class and is the daughter of well, it's not so much a social class as a class of divinity. I believe it's Pitri, or Pitri. That's P-I-T-R-I. Which, there are human and deity Pitri, but essentially they're like the forebearers. They're kind of like ancestral spirits. And humans have them, and the gods have them as well. Yeah, depending on, again, which version of Manavati you're talking about, she's either the daughter of Mount Meru or a member of one of the forebearers of the gods. I think his name was, her father's name was Kavi. I forget who her mother is in that story, but regardless. So there's a couple of different explanations of her mother's origin. In addition, she's also the sister of Parvati, who is a goddess of... she's a goddess of quite a lot of things, actually. But she is also the reincarnation of Shiva's wife, Sati. She's the, I think, the second incarnation of her. I haven't brushed up on my Shiva mythology recently, so excuse me on that one. But yeah, so... Ganga is, she's a primordial force, she's the river itself, but she's also forgiveness, purification. Even today, even though the Ganges is very polluted by not just human activity, but other types of industrial waste, it's still considered sacred. Even if the water itself looks dirty, it is always pure. In the eyes of very religious and traditional Hindu worshippers, and there is a lot of efforts to kind of clean up the river, though those have been very hit or miss. And there's a lot of animals that we might not expect to find in the Hindu River. Specifically, there's a type of South Asian dolphin that swims up those rivers, and I really hope that they that they're able to save that, because that is a very critically endangered species. There's some types of crocodiles that are in the rivers, though they are not nearly as large as Nile crocodiles, but they are, they are crocodiles, so they can be extremely dangerous. And then, of course, there's so many types of fish, it's hard to list them all. So that is the primary river, the Ganges. That's where the name comes from. In a lot of the later texts and oral traditions, the Ganges is considered the most important river in Hindu cosmology. There are other rivers that are praised and, that are important, but she's kind of given, the prime position in their worldview. Today, there are a number, again, of just large tributaries feeding into the Ganges. You have the Yamuna, the Banas, the Chambal, the Betwa, the Tamsa, the Gamti, the Sun, the Gagara, the Gandak, Kasi, and then there's the Damodar. Just a huge number of named and unnamed rivers and streams and lakes and all that kind of stuff that feed into this. And also, of course, monsoons do happen in this region, so they will blow in and contribute their rains there as well. For now, though, we turn to the Brahmaputra, which is the other big river in this side of the subcontinent. Now, the name for this is very straightforward. Brahma is referring to the god, and Putra is, I believe, an old Sanskrit word meaning son of or child of. I don't know if it's gendered or not. I did not read into that. But essentially, it's always considered the son of Brahma. Now, Brahma is of the kind of the Hindu god of creation, knowledge, wisdom. I believe he's the one that is the inspiration for the Vedas. which are, you know, very important Hindu texts, and before that, oral traditions. So, very important god. He's not as actively worshipped, I don't believe, today, but he is one of the big three in Hindu cosmology. He's the creator. You've got Vishnu, who's kind of the preserver of the world order. Then you've got Shiva, who is the destroyer, which we'll get into the, those three later, as they all relate to each other. But like a lot of primordial gods, Brahma isn't quite as worshipped in day-to-day life. He's done his work. He's resting. He's kind of just giving humanity knowledge, or, helping them, obtain knowledge. He's not quite as active. Now, Hindus mythology, there's a lot of versions of those, or I should say branches of it. They're very concerned with cycles of life, death, rebirth. And that's not just on a human level or an animal level, but that's like in terms of long periods of time. So there will come a point again where, after the universe ends, Brahma will recreate it, and he has recreated it several times, or at least, incarnations of Brahma. And we'll get into reincarnation stuff later. I'm still trying to wrap my head around a lot of this stuff. It is very deep. And as an outsider and someone who does not speak any Sanskrit or read any Sanskrit or any, modern languages in India, it's a lot to wrap your head around. There are very good translations out there, but it sometimes you feel like you're missing stuff, even if it is, accurately translated. But one thing with the Brahmaputra is that it starts in the Tibetan plateau, and it actually runs quite a long way, kind of parallel, I guess, to the north of the, or I guess before it begins to descend from the Tibetan plateau. It kind of follows along like a long ridge, and then as it turns, it picks up more and more tributaries, and more things feed into it. And during the part before it begins to get some of those tributaries feeding into it, it does have another name, at least in Tibetan and China. It's known as the Yerlong Zhangbo or the Tsangpo, depending on the version of Chinese or Tibetan you're using. But once it begins to meet the Loet and the Subansiri rivers in what today, the Subansiri runs through Bhutan, and the Lohit also comes down kind of from the Tibetan plateau. But once those two waters kind of meet the Tsangpo, then it becomes collectively known as the Brahmaputra. And once it gets off the plateau, it really picks up speed, and the amount of water that it gets is a lot heavier. It has a lot of flow once it gets through, or starts to, like, fall downhill from the Tibetan plateau. So depending on where you are, it may have a different name. And there are a couple of other big rivers that feed into that. I think it's the Barak and the Meghana as well. And these are coming from the mountains that kind of form the barrier between the modern country of Myanmar and Bangladesh. That's where the Barak and the Surma are coming down from. And those rivers where they meet a couple of other smaller things are called the Meghna. And where the Brahmaputra and the Ganges meet together is known as the Padma. And the Padma and the Meghna meet, and they all flow out of the mouth of the Ganges into the Bay of Bengal. So as you can guess, there's a lot of well-watered, fertile land in this area. And that will become important when agriculture begins to be imported. During this season, that hasn't happened just yet. Or it may be better to say it's not happening at quite a large scale. Much like the subcontinent, or the southern part of the subcontinent, if agriculture is being practiced, it's at a very small level, and it's only as a supplement to a more traditional human lifestyle of hunting, gathering, and, of course, with all these rivers in the area, fishing is also a big part of that, too. But before I forget, I did... So, I could not get a Tibetan translation of the name. I'm working on for the Yarlung Tsongpo, but the Chinese characters that they use, Ya Lu Zhang Bu Zhang, Zhang is river, but the Ya Lu Zhang Bu is something like elegant Lu Tibetan cloth. I think the Lu is just like a kind of meant to be like a placeholder or to kind of mimic the Tibetan name for the river, but it's something like the characters used in Chinese, it's like an elegant cloth from Tibet might be the best translation for the river. Though, again, I don't know what the etymology is in the Tibetan language. I am going to go ahead and talk about what is now the country of Bhutan. This is kind of a very mountainous region, obviously, being kind of in the right along the Himalaya, I guess, border between Tibet and India. And there isn't really any evidence of permanent settlement there until about 2000 BC. And then you see a lot of stone tools pop up. There's evidence of elephants being hunted there, or in some cases even kept at that point. But I do think people were living there. It's probably just they're in very small numbers, and it's more of a they're passing through the region, either up to the Tibetan Plateau or going down one of the numerous river valleys like the Suspansuri and the, I forget the other big river that comes down through Bhutan, but they're probably going down those, or following the roots of the river to get to where the Brahmaputra valley kind of runs through. So, no evidence of this season that there's anyone living permanently, but again, I imagine it's kind of one of those areas that's frequented by a lot of people, or at least not necessarily a lot of people, because it can't support a large population, but, you know, it's probably occupied at some level. And that kind of leads into a good place to talk about Nepal. Nepal is a little bit better off in terms of water. There are a couple of different tributaries of the Ganges that flow directly through Nepal. The Gandak, the Khasi, the Gagara. These are all the big tributaries that are flowing south. And there are other rivers that kind of flow through areas of those as well. And Nepal has a fairly large population for its size. It has around 31 million people. But there is evidence in Nepal of a couple of different groups living there. You have, obviously, people coming up from the south, possibly Dravidian speakers or people related to Dravidian speakers. You have groups coming down from the Tibetan Plateau as well. There may have been groups that had been living there, you know, through one valley or another since humans arrived there. So we're talking at least 55,000 years ago. Though, again, that's kind of debated if they were there permanently or if they were just kind of moving through the area, you know, doing the whole hunter-gatherer thing. But regardless, it's as it's a border region, it is, you know, occupied by probably a couple of different portions of these macro groups in other areas. And it's an area where you'll see a lot of mixing of different cultures, and that's kind of one of the reasons it is very unique today, and that's true in the past. But by this season, 6,000 to 4,000, you see a couple of different sites, all showing different levels of technology or different types of tool configurations. You still have some groups that are using Paleolithic style tools, you know, these larger stone there are some stone weapons, but also larger stone tools, hand axes, things like that. And then you have Mesolithic and Neolithic groups that are beginning to emerge as well. Though, you know, who's bringing what is also debated. And by the time of the Mahabharata and other Hindu scriptures, there are, you know, they are aware of people living in the area. They are interacting with them. Much like, you know, evidence of people being in Kabul, they make mention of these peoples living kind of in this border region of the Tibetan Plateau. So these are very long-standing points of contact between a couple different groups. And, you know, again, just due to the amount of tools and things like that, it's pretty obvious that this area is occupied fairly, you know, fairly well by a sizable population of at least a couple of different groups. Possibly there are some groups also that are importing cattle and goats and sheep and things like that. So this is a region that's probably undergoing kind of that early pastoralism. I haven't found anything mentioning agriculture just yet, though again, it's probable that, you know, on some level they have started to tend to like kind of that early stage of horticulture / proto-agriculture that they're beginning to experiment with. Though even after agriculture does spread to this region, there's not really a polity in terms of like a centralized state or city. I think Kathmandu, which is obviously the capital today, it's not founded until the first millennium AD. But there have been people probably living in and around the area in smaller villages and in tribal groups, all throughout, you know, that little section of the Himalayas, again, going back to the time. But even after agriculture gets to the region, there's no formal centralized state of any kind, again, until much later. Though there are dynasties and things like that that are reported to have existed. They just, they weren't organized in kind of a single polity until that first millennia in the AD. All right, and let's see. We're running about 27 minutes right now. I was going to talk a little bit about sites along the Ganges and Brahmaputra and peoples, but I think this is kind of a good length for this episode, and I did knock out half of kind of the area that we'd be talking about. I was planning on it being the other half this episode, but I guess I got the kind of seemed like a good part to kind of include all that stuff in there. So we will go ahead and call this episode for this week, and I'll get it posted and up in time to go up at the regular period. But thanks everyone who came out this week and listened. I hope you've enjoyed. If you have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can contact me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can send me a direct message on X/Twitter. You can also comment on the YouTube channel. That would be great too. And I do try to answer those as best as I can, as fast as I can. Though, again, if you comment on earlier episodes, I'm probably going to see them a little bit sooner. But yeah, thank you all for joining me this week. We will continue, and we'll probably finish up this part of the world for this season, and then we'll move into either Southeast Asia or possibly just cover the Tibetan Plateau, depending on, I guess, how much time I take on the other stuff. But yeah, we're making decent progress. But regardless, once we finish up the Tibetan Plateau in Southeast Asia, we'll kind of cover China, Japan, Korea, those areas, Mongolia, essentially East Asia, and then we'll probably take a detour to Austronesia, Australia, that kind of area, and then we'll go ahead and finish up Asia, kind of in the north and to back towards the west, and then we'll do Europe and then the Americas. So yeah, thank you all again. I've really enjoyed doing these episodes, and I'm glad people seem to enjoy them, and I hope I've been respectful in terms of talking about the areas and kind of given a good picture. But there are a couple of things that we'll talk about next week to, again, finish up the kind of the Indian subcontinent for this season. So thank you all for joining me. I hope you have a good rest of your day and week from whenever you're listening to this. And I'll see everyone next time. Peace.